And I went from running very little money to running an awful lot of money. And I got married. So I went from being unmarried, having no children, and very little responsibility and enjoying myself, to employing 35 people, getting married, having two kids, and the markets being incredibly challenging. Mm. And my marriage failed. And I look back on it now. My ex-wife was here last night. We're best friends. But I think it was, that was the kind of the unwinding of the career I'd chosen. It brought some degree of wealth, some degree of success, but no happiness and no stability in my life. Yeah. And my road to redemption from every perspective was photography.
Everyone has ambitions. To start their own business, to lose weight, to launch a podcast. But for most of us, those ambitions are still on the to-do list. We'll get round to them one day. But some people overcome procrastination. That thing you'd love to do, they knew the risks, but said screw it, and just did it anyway. On the Screw It, Just Do It podcast, I'm on a mission to answer one simple question. How do you get to where you want to be? Joining me are inspirational entrepreneurs, sports stars, entertainers, and authors who took the leap. They became the people they wanted to be. They did what they always wanted to do. In this series of revealing, challenging, and often surprising conversations, they might just help you discover how to do it too.
Welcome to episode 171 of Screw It, Just Do It. I'm your host, Alex Chisnell. And on today's show, it's a real pleasure to welcome David Yarrow, one of the best-selling fine art photographers in the world today. His photographs sell for upwards of $100,000 and hang in the homes of actor and fellow conservationist Leonardo DiCaprio and New England Patriots quarterback Tom Brady, to name but two. His latest book includes a foreword by Tom Brady himself, whilst his previous book sold out numerous times and has a foreword by Prince William. But it wasn't always so. He chose a career in finance over a career in photography, spurning a job with Getty despite taking the iconic image of Diego Maradona holding the World Cup aloft in 1986. He eventually launched his own hedge fund before losing it all in the financial crisis, his marriage, his business, everything. He decided to go all in on photography and has built an unrivaled reputation documenting the most remarkable aspects of human nature and the animal kingdom, whilst exploring some of the world's most dangerous, breathtaking, and remote environments on Earth. You may not think you've even got an interest in photography, but I guarantee you would have seen at least one or two of David's photographs in your lifetime. From his iconic image of Diego Maradona holding the World Cup trophy aloft in 1986, he's now the world's best-selling wildlife photographer, with images including great white sharks, lions, tigers, bears, plus recent images of actresses and supermodels including Cara Delevingne, Pamela Anderson, and Cindy Crawford. I caught up with David at the Maddox Gallery in Notting Hill, London, fresh from his appearance on Piers Morgan's TV show and following gallery showings with the likes of England football captain Harry Kane. In this episode, David and I chat about redundancy, how to get out of a job that's becoming increasingly redundant, research, and how to load the dice in your favour, and how. Being in an era where people want to know how you do what you do. Let's start up.
You're working for the Times as a photographer, and you're covering the World Cup final in Mexico City in 1986, which is the first World Cup final I can actually remember seeing on TV as a kid. That's become a pretty iconic picture. What do you remember about that now, looking back through that kind of vision?
I remember so much about that day. It's funny because I remember more about Top of the Pops in 1986 and football matches in 86. My son's knowledge of football now is encyclopedic, but he doesn't know anything about 1986, so it's the other way around.
Yeah.
I remember getting to the Azteca Stadium. I was staying in a shithole of a hotel. It was probably about $5 a night because I was still a student at Edinburgh University at that stage.
I didn't know that.
So my mate, I finished my last exam and flew straight over there, and I don't think it would have happened now, but FIFA gave me the accreditation. And there was a rule then that if your team, if your country had qualified for the finals, that you would be, they would allow one photographer from every country that qualified to get a pitch pass for the final.
Yeah.
Obviously, Scotland been sent home very early. And with it, the photographers from Scottish newspapers, like the Glasgow Herald or the Daily Record, most importantly. So I was the last photographer left because I was effectively freelance. So the Times said, well, listen, we could do with another photographer on the pitch, given that you're around and I knew the guys there. And I remember going to Aztec at 6 a.m. and had a little bit of whiskey on me. And I bribed the Mexican guard in the press area to say, can I walk from the onto the pitch? And there were just some crows and there was some early morning fog. And I walked from one goalpost to the other and I could see my footprints in the dew. And it was an epiphany in many ways. I remember thinking, this is it. This is maybe what I'm going to be doing with my life. I wasn't a good photographer. And I must admit, that whole Mexico thing, a lot of the games were at midday, including the final for European TV times.
Yeah.
And I was lucky. I had a good final. And when the final whistle came, I had a big lens of 400 to cover the midfield area. And then I had a small wide angle lens. And I thought, you know, the only way I'm going to get close to Maradona is to leave my camera gear in the netting in the goal. Because if I started to try and carry that, I would never be nimble enough to get close to Maradona. And of course, it was in the days of film, so you didn't know what you had. But I knew that he had looked right at me with his arms aloft and the World Cup in one hand. And on that day, there must have been about 10, 15,000 Argentinians on the pitch. And I kind of, after I walked back to the net, this is about 25 minutes after the presentation of the cup, I thought, my gear is probably gone. But I did the right thing because I think I've got a picture. And I got back to the net and there was my camera lens in the net. And I've always had a fondness for Argentinians after that because it wasn't about nicking anything from the stadium. It was about they just won the World Cup.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then, of course, you go through the period where you have to wait a few hours to get your film back from Fuji and Kodak, who sponsor the World Cup. And it was the only time in my time in Mexico that they had a thing called the Aztec two-step, which basically means you got food poisoning, you have to be on the loo the whole time. And those few hours, I was on the loo the whole time.
Really?
I just couldn't move.
Oh, no, disaster.
Anyway, we got the picture, and I'm not being modest, I'm being truthful. It was about the only decent picture I got in the whole tournament. And
really?
Just about, really? Yeah. I got some stuff of Zico. It was a great Brazilian side. They got knocked out by France in what a lot of people consider to be still one of the best ever World Cup games, the France-Brazil quarterfinal in Guadalajara. Mm. And being on the pitch there was very exciting as well.
I bet. And you can remember that moment that you say that you caught Maradona looking right at you with the cover. Yeah. And how many years ago was that?
22.
Wow, yes. It's 23. Interesting. 23 years ago. It's interesting because I chatted to my wife the other night and she was saying, we remember being in a hotel in Johannesburg and she came down to reception and it was mobbed and she's only little. She was walking through and the crowd just parted and there in front of her was Nelson Mandela. Uh-huh. She said he just looked straight at her. And then before you know it, all the security guards enveloped her and he was away. But she goes, I've always just remembered that, like, true, eye contact. And I just thought, do you remember that?
And eyes are so important.
And so you were still at uni then. Yeah. So when you went back, what did you do next then? Was that last term?
I then did, things then moved forward a bit. And I did the Olympics, the Winter Olympics for Getty. And it was my final year at university. And my parents were not happy and my tutors at Edinburgh were not happy. But I said, I'm only going to get one chance to photograph a Winter Olympics. And so it was kind of weird because I'd take all my books out. I was studying business studies and economics and I would be photographing the men's downhill in the morning and then in the afternoon I would be looking at economic curves. It was a very weird combination.
Indeed.
And at what point then did you decide to pursue a career in finance?
Well, it came, I think there was one part of it was actually in Calgary. There were some moments in the editing room, and this again was still in film, where there were just so many photographers there. Mm. And There is a saying, if you ever met a happy photographer, and I like to think I'm quite a happy photographer, but in the press, there are a lot of fairly miserable photographers. And it struck me there was two things. I looked up to my boss, and actually my boss then, I employ his daughter. My boss was a guy called Dave Cannon, who's the best golf photographer in the world, and he worked for All Sport, which became part of Getty. Mm. But I just worried that it was difficult to get original content. As a sports photographer, how could you get a picture that no one else had, given the number of photographers? And if you take, you know, Wimbledon Centre Court, there are probably 80 people with very good cameras. So how can you get a picture? I used to love photographing McEnroe or Connors, but it was difficult to get something that was art or just different. And it was a bit of peer pressure as well. A lot of my friends, it was in the era of Oliver Stone's Wall Street, and working in that kind of environment seemed to be glamorous, and I was using my degree. So it came down to, I was offered a starting salary of 15,000 to work for Getty or All Sport, and a salary of 15,000 to work for NatWest Bank. And all the guys at All Sport couldn't believe it, but I chose NatWest Bank. And that was obviously a very big decision of mine, but it was the right decision. And I look back now, and I saw one of my friends from the old days, not too long ago, he said, we recognize probably that you wouldn't have been doing now what you're doing now if you hadn't done what you did. Because I learned a lot. I made a lot of good contacts. And I learned about supply and demand. And all the time I was looking at the photography market and how it was changing. So I spent quite a bit of my time when I was in finance, watching and becoming a scholar of the history of commercial photography, the photographers I aspired to be like, my heroes. And so for a while, whilst I was working in finance, photography was never airbrushed out of my mind. It was it was there, but not in a commercial way.
And your parents must have been happy.
My mum wanted me to be a photographer. My dad wanted me to go into banking. So there were some, but you know, it shows how much the world has changed, because in 1988, banking was seen as an honorable profession and photography was seen as something that weirdos did. Whereas now banking is seen as something that weirdos do and photography seems to be an honorable profession.
Yeah.
So it's got 180 degrees.
It has. And how much do you think, looking back, like when you're saying how difficult it would have been to get a sports photograph that would stand out, how difficult is it these days for those guys who are doing that as a profession? Do you think you'd have to go to something like one of the snowboarding events where it might be further out off piste or in the back country to get something decent?
I know a lot of sports photographers now, and I've got a huge admiration for some of them that have been doing it for an awful long time. They're very talented, and they work sometimes in very tough conditions. They hard days work, and they're battling all the time with that riddle as to how do you get something different, but also how does it become art? And if you take a picture of Tiger Woods punching his fist when he's just won the US Masters, you also have a slight problem in that Augusta kind of slightly owned that picture in terms of you then trying to sell it as fine art in a gallery. So you've got two layers of problems. Is it art? And then if it is art, well, you shot it at Augusta golf course, you might have to be slightly careful in terms of the intellectual property of that. But the vast majority of sports photography is reportage. It is recording a moment. Mm. It is taking a picture, not necessarily making it.
Yeah.
Some good sports photographers are able to make pictures because they have a preconception in their mind, and then a fairly rigorous linear curve between that preconception and creating the picture. But it's, if you look at a Sotheby's photographic auction like last week in New York, there won't be a sports photograph in it. Right. If there is, it will be of Muhammad Ali, that famous picture perhaps when he knocked out Sonny Lister, and when he's going, it will be a historic picture. But I speak to a lot of sports photographers these days, and they ask me questions about how I've built up in my brand in the fine art market. I do also think they could help by turning those pictures into black and white as well, because it lends a historical feel. And because black and white is interpretive rather than reality, it lends itself to the sense that it is art rather than
timeless.
Yep.
Potentially. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And during that time, did you keep photography as a hobby, or did you completely cast it aside?
It was a hobby. But equally, sometimes when you would go and make investor pictures of what I was doing At the end of it, I'd say, but do you want to see a picture of an elephant? So there was an extent to which I didn't hide the fact. I had an insecurity as a running a finance business, and I'm very open about it now in that I was never going to be the best. And I knew people that were better than me at doing what I was doing. I was trading and I had a team of traders with me.
Yeah.
I was okay. We saw ourselves through 9/11, all right. And we managed that period very well between the two planes. We did some smart stuff and we took all our risk off the table before the second plane went in. But that's kind of luck as well as judgment. Mm. I mean, anyone could have done that. It just worked. And I went from running very little money to running an awful lot of money. And I got married. So I went from being unmarried, having no children and very little responsibility and enjoying myself, to employing 35 people, getting married, having two kids, and the markets being incredibly challenging. Mm. And my marriage failed. And I look back on it now. My ex-wife was here last night. We're best friends. But I think that was the kind of the unwinding of the career I'd chosen. It brought some degree of wealth, some degree of success, but no happiness and no stability in my life. Yeah. And my road to redemption from every perspective was photography. People react to divorce in lots of different ways, and sadly it's just a fact of life that it happens. My antidote was to just go to the far-flung corners of the world on my own with my cameras. And I didn't really know what I was going to do when I got there. I didn't really know. I was just escapism.
Yeah,
and trying to find some peace.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd end up in, you know, I guess a lot of people when they get divorced, they end up in Annabelle's nightclub. I ended up in small fishing villages in Greenland.
And that was going from, say, NatWest, transitioning through and setting up your own hedge fund business. Okay.
I set that up in 1997 when I was young. And I think when the financial markets collapsed in 2008, we'd kind of managed our way through it fairly well because I'm a Scot and I was very, very nervous about the Scottish banks having overextended themselves.
Mm.
And so we'd bet on the Scottish banks overextending themselves. So we actually got through the year okay. And then on the 8th of December, I woke up to these headlines that this person, Bernie Madoff, had been arrested and handed himself into the FBI for fraud. And I hadn't heard of the guy. And it's amazing. I was so naive. I didn't realize that it was going to kill my business because of the money that we were managing, so much of it was from clients that had just lost a lot of their money with Madoff, and therefore their clients were going to pool their money. So I became an ATM machine for all the problems elsewhere.
Mm.
So our business collapsed overnight. And I remember thinking to myself, and this was when I was single and struggling anyway, I remember thinking, I've got to find something in my life, because I was still early, I felt, where I'm not going to be hostage to exogenous variables, as so much hostage as exogenous variables as that.
Yeah.
I want to be, because we'd done nothing wrong and our business collapsed overnight because of a guy I'd never heard of.
Yeah, and how many people did you have working for you then?
We downsized, but it was still around about 15.
Was it?
Yeah. And we got through it by cutting costs, by me taking their salary.
Yeah.
But that was the point that I knew that I had to get out. The problem you've got, and I feel for this, and I speak to a lot of people in finance now that want to get out, because just like the job of being a travel agency or a Thomas Cook has gone, or a book retailer, unless you're the very best book retailer, the job of working in stock markets is just about redundant now because of the speed of information, because of compliance. Because I was playing information arbitrage, but the ability to play information arbitrage has been crushed by the general availability of information and the correct sense that no one should have any better information than anyone else because it's illegal.
Yeah.
So what my job effectively is redundant. Mm. And for people, there are a lot of people in that position. And when I ask them, or they ask me, I need to get out. How did you do it, David? How did you do it? Well, I'm lucky in that I did have a skill or a talent that I could fall back on.
Mm.
But I spent probably 5 years developing my business model before I left.
Did you?
Yeah. So if you have a train, and my train has slowed down. My train was going about as slow as some of these trains do going through London at the moment. But I needed to jump onto a train that wasn't stationary because I had kids and school fees. Yeah. I had alimony. I had bills to pay. And so if you turn around and say, I ain't going to be a photographer, but I need to earn $500,000 a year, that's a tough filter in photography. Yeah. But yeah. That was my mindset. I'd say, in order to do this, I'm going to have to earn $500,000 a year. And obviously, I didn't to begin with.
No, but that's the target.
I set myself. In order to be, you get taxed. So that half of that goes. Mm. And then you think, well, I've got school fees to pay for, other bits and pieces, and a little bit of money for me to live off. It's going to be that kind of number.
And can you remember the first place that you went to outside of the UK where you started kind of experimenting with what you're doing? What kind of far-flung place did you start going to?
If you enjoy listening to podcasts and you feel inspired to start your own, you can get a copy of my free podcast launch checklist by going to podpreneur.co.uk/launch checklist. And if you'd like the hands-on help and support of myself and my team at my podcast agency, Podpreneur, we've been producing podcasts with purpose internationally since 2019. Just drop me a line about your podcast idea to alex@podpreneur.co.uk. But if you prefer to do it all yourself, but with my guidance, you can join the waitlist for my upcoming podcast academy by going to podpreneur.co.uk/academy.
Well, there were two moments along the road. There were two tipping points along the road. The first was probably about 2009, and I got so a year after the world turned upside down, and it was still fairly miserable then. And I got quite interested in photographing sharks, great white sharks. And in those days, the best place to photograph great whites, not underwater, because you can do that anywhere, but predating, i.e. coming out of the water. Mm. The best place to do that was in a place called False Bay, just around the corner from Cape Town. In June and July, i.e. their winter, you get this extraordinary behavior, or you did, where there would be a congregation of great whites and they would predate on seals. They would come flying out of the water. Yeah. So a lot of my mates saw me going down to Cape Town on a Friday night. You arrive too late to shoot on the Saturday morning. So you spend Saturday morning kicking around, and then I would go out on the Sunday morning and then the Monday morning and go back to London that night. I did this six times, and the first five times I got nothing. And my friends were thinking, you know, I'm a bit worried about David. Maybe, you know, maybe he's lost it a little bit. But I knew I had to get it. And the final day, I did get the shot, and it went around the world. Mm. I remember when I was in Simonstown looking at it, because now we're in the days of digital. And I looked at the screen and I saw that the shark was pin sharp, the seal that the shark's flying to capture is pin sharp. And I got quite emotional on my own. And I'll never forget it. And there's a saying from a Mark Twain quote. He says the two most important days in a man's life or a woman's life are the day they're born and the day they find out why. And I guess I was 43, 42. And I think that was the moment. The problem then was that I got my check from Getty for the picture, which had been distributed everywhere. Mm. And there's obviously a time delay. And I think it was about $16,000, and I worked out it cost me $18,000 to take the picture.
Oh wow! So all those trips.
Yeah. So I thought, this is actually a shit business model.
Yeah.
I've lost $2,000 taking this picture. I'm better stay, not give up the day job. But then, someone from Texas called me up 2 months later, and he said, "Are you the kid that took the photograph of the shark?" I said, "I think I might be." He said, "Well, I'm an attorney from Houston. I'm called Jaws, and we need one of them for our office wall." But in 2009, it was not the way you looked at how you were going to monetize strong photography. You didn't think about it as a fine art thing. Mm. So I didn't know what to charge him. He said, how much for that? And I said, well, what about 6,000 pounds, dollars? I can't remember. And he, I remember him saying 6,000. So I thought I'd gone way too high.
No.
So I said, well, we'll deliver it for free. And he said, no, we're going to have three of them. And that was when the penny dropped. And I tell this story a few times, but you remember in Jerry Maguire where Tom Cruise stays up all night and he writes his missive that sports agents have too many stars and they should have smaller number of people that they should look after. Mm. And so he writes this piece, stays up all night, and puts it in everyone's cubbyhole. And then he gets fired 2 days later. I wrote my piece about how photography is going to change. And I circulated it. And I got a lot of stick for it from people that didn't agree. Mm. Press photographers, stuff like that. Some good mates of mine, actually. And I was right, though. That has been proved to be right because stock has been crushed. Everyone's a photographer now. And digital pays less than physical. So you've got a reduction in demand and ever-increasing supply. Mm. I think there's a statistic that, you know, Getty have about 11,000 affiliated photographers, i.e. non-staff photographers.
Yeah.
And I think about 10 years ago, the top one of those, who's going to be very good, must have an amazing library of stock, got paid close to $1 million. Good money. But he's the top of 11,000. And 10 years on, he's probably got 10 years more content. And that million number's fallen by 30%. Really? So all you need to know is one thing, and that's probably that kind of thing you need to know.
And what was the second tipping point then for you?
Second tipping point was a tough one for me, where I'd had a very tough year in 2014. I'd had a tough year financially, had a relationship that hadn't worked out, partly because I was putting the kids first and so I was sort of left in no man's land. And it turned out that Christmas Day I wasn't gonna be seeing my children. And I know it's just one day a year, but it was a tough thing for me. And I thought to myself, well, if I'm not gonna see my kids, I'll probably wanna be as far away as possible and doing something. And also I was at a stage where I never suffer from depression, but I thought I'm going to go in harm's way because what the hell. Mm. So I went into the civil war in South Sudan, and I was in South Sudan on Christmas Day. And then 2 days later, I took a picture that changed my life. And I remember as soon as I took it, I knew probably that it was big. And from there, because I'd had big collectors turn me down, or gatekeepers to collectors in America, particularly one guy in Palm Beach, who's one of the most important photographic scholars that's alive. He turned me down 5 times. And because my work was just not, it was okay. It just, for him to represent me probably meant removing someone else from his roster.
Right.
And went back from Sudan to Kenya, got back to London, saw my kids, and then I went to LA, got it, worked on the picture, and then I took the picture to Miami, all within about 8 days. And the guy looked at the picture, and he said, right, I'll represent you. And I sold my finance business the next day from South Beach, probably after too many cocktails. So it all happened, that period between taking the picture and selling my business was about 8 days.
And that was Mankind, I think. Pretty damn iconic.
That's yeah, cool. Now yeah. People pay over $100,000 to get a copy, and you can't actually get one.
You can't, no. really.
But a lot of people have turned around to me and said, well, what an extraordinary career change. Mm. But there's a clue in that the reason Mankind was a strong picture is that I'd researched the area for so many evenings, and I knew that every photographer, and not many photographers had been up there, but they'd all made one. Error is too strong a word. I felt they'd missed something because the topography is very flat around the Nile and there's no trees. There's nothing to get raised elevation on. Yeah. And in order to create the depth of this enormous cattle camp, you had to have raised elevation. Because otherwise, if you're on the ground and the ground's flat, you're just going to see it's like a school picture. Mm. That's why school pictures have to be taken on ladders so you can get everything. Yeah. You know. So I took a ladder all the way up through South Sudan and across the Nile. And that was what made it, was the ladder. Wow. And that's research. So my old job was about research, and to an extent, this job was about research as well.
That's a connection. And Where do you stand, or how much do you embrace technology? Because as you said yourself now, in theory, everybody's a photographer with a smartphone. How much do you embrace that yourself? How much do you embrace the media that comes with it, the social media to use to share what you do and to promote what you do?
Okay, well, so a few things. I'm very proud to be Nikon's European ambassador. America call it Nikon, but we're going to stick with Nikon because we're in Notting Hill. A camera is just a conduit. A camera is a piece of metal. Photography has got very little to do with the cameras, everything to do with your heart and your soul and your eyes. And it's Ansel Adams said, photography is about the poems you've read, the loves you've made, the music you've listened to, the loves you've lost, and the photographs of others. In other words, he was saying that it's about being a sponge, image-wise, and also it's a sort of outer manifestation of your inner soul.
Yeah.
So whether it's analog or digital or whatever, it doesn't change your ability to be a photographer and frame things and see things. But clearly photographs have got cameras have got a lot better. And that allows me to print my images very big. And we've certainly seen a trend towards big art. Right. And big art sells better than small art. Mm. If you take a Helmut Newton that's the size of a Helmut Newton photograph that's the size of, I don't know, a cocktail tray, it gets lost in many rooms,
yeah.
Irrespective. And of course, those pictures were taken, you know, with cameras that are difficult to blow them up the size of a snooker table.
Mm.
Now we've got cameras that you can blow up pictures to the size of the snooker table without too much noise.
Yeah.
So we embrace it. The new cameras that have come out very much suit me because they allow for so much information. And I'm into detail, textural detail, and as much information in the picture as possible. With regard to social media, I think it's a necessary evil. Yeah. I'm afraid that the first thing a lot of people look at, when we look at a new gallery that approaches, the first thing we look at is how many social media followers they got. If they've got 500, we worry about that gallery.
Yeah.
Irrespective of anything else. If they've got 50,000, which is good for an aggregator of other people's work, we go, well, they've got that in order.
Yeah.
I think it's a first filter in terms of whether you've got your house in order. Does it make a difference to us whether we've got 400,000 now or 800,000? Not really, but we'd like it to be accretive.
Yeah.
And it is a good way of meeting people. You know, last night we had half the West Ham football team here. The first way that we got to know them was through social media.
Yeah.
And sports stars around the world who've been very supportive to me, a lot of that contact has come through social media.
And Brooklyn Beckham as well, is that right?
Yeah. And Tom Brady, who's written the foreword to my book, he's been very supportive to me.
How did you come across? I'm a huge American football fan. So how did you come across a Tom Brady?
Well, Mankind was being shown in Aspen, and a guy came in who he's had an interesting couple of months. Who is the creative director of Victoria's Secrets, and he's now a great friend of mine, a guy called Ed Razak. And Ed has got an incredible eye, incredible attention to detail, which is why he's had done an amazing career at Victoria's Secret. He obviously knew Giselle, and I think he was quite instrumental in Giselle meeting Tom. So he introduced Tom to my work. And Tom then, went to Boston to see him and delivered a picture. And he is a very impressive man. He's a charming man. He's kind. He's great with my kids. And he's a conservationist, as is she. And things just built forward from there.
Amazing. Amazing. And then how did you make that leap then from photographing Diego Maradona, photographing dangerous wild animals and supermodels?
You know, I don't think what's in front of the camera should bend back and affect the camera's ability to photograph it. Someone once said to me, which is a little bit silly, David, but you can't shoot me, you shoot animals. So the idea that if I showed a photograph of a zebra on Monday, that if I was asked to photograph a person on Tuesday, I'd struggle because I'm a zebra photographer. It's a little bit silly. I'm subject agnostic, but the subject's got to interest me.
Yeah.
There's a very good quote that someone once said, if you want to be a better photographer, put better things in front of your camera. And that's so true. I mean, it sounds simplistic, but it's true. If the pictures are not good enough, maybe you could do with some better things in front of the camera to photograph.
Yeah.
And iconic big animals, dangerous animals, animals that have been disrespected, are fairly powerful things to put in front of a camera, particularly if you're close.
Yeah.
As is Cindy Crawford.
Indeed, as we are looking right up at her and the wolf there, absolutely. And do you, is it one of these things that it's almost like trying to pick one of your favorite children? Like, you don't have a favorite that you've taken over the years, or are there those iconic ones that, like, you see those tipping points, that Mankind or something?
Yeah, I mean, Mankind's a big image, and the wolf on the bar in Montana that we call the Wolf of Main Street. Leo's DiCaprio's got a copy of that, which is nice, because it was just nice. After the Wolf of Wall Street. I think the big picture I've taken this in the show this week called Squad, which has got the two biggest elephants in the world.
Yeah.
It's the first picture that my team have turned around to me and said, I don't think demand for this picture is going to be influenced by the price. Mm. And we shot it 5 weeks ago, and the picture is almost sold out. So manifestly, we did price it wrong. And one of the tough things for me is to work out, I'm riddled with my own insecurity and I'm very tough on myself. But sometimes when you take a big picture, you've got to have the balls to turn around and say, we're going to try and we'll put this flag up and see if it flies. What you never want to do is misjudge on the upside and then bring it down, because that's embarrassing. So you tend to be conservative and move forward. But that picture, we started, I think, at £50,000 for one, and they've all gone. And so therefore, that was the wrong price.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. And last question for you is, what point when you went all in on photography, at what point in that journey, or how long into that journey, did you think, this is the right decision, I'm going to realize all of the dreams, the ambitions that I had? Or you're not there yet?
I you always want to be a creative, so the journey's, we're mid-journey. We've got lots to do, and you should get better. There's no, old age or middle age or whatever doesn't have many redeeming features, but one good thing is you should become a better photographer, because I think you become more emotionally intelligent. And also, if you don't make the same mistake twice, which of course you do, it should be an aggregation of all the mistakes you have made. So I should get better. I think I am getting better. And we've got capital now to throw at projects, which is very handy. So we don't get worried about the cost of a project within reason.
Right.
I think there was a moment in Amsterdam where, in my old book, and I said I would be book signing for the weekend in Amsterdam. And there was a queue half a mile long in Amsterdam. And I thought, wow, people are queuing, waiting. There's 2 hours to wait.
Wow.
And people waited. And that, me, I was very flattered, of course.
Mm.
But that was a moment I thought, we've got a brand.
Yeah.
But there's been many bumps along the way. I remember our third most important city in the world is Dallas. And I always fancied that Dallas would be a good market for us. It's a lot of wall space, a lot of money there, and a love of the big outdoors.
Yeah.
But when I first arrived in Dallas, no one understandably knew who the hell I was. And the final event we had in Dallas, three people turned up, one of whom was my PR girl. And so I think there was one guest. And we were $100,000 down in Dallas in costs before we made our first big sale. Wow. So there's a J curve in terms of going south cash flow wise, which you have in every city. It's very rare that you start in a fresh city and you make money straight away.
Yeah.
The nice position is now we've got a lot of cities where they're fine. So it's like the plate spinner, you know. You can't have too many, they're wobbling. Mm. And to begin with, we nearly didn't make it because our cash was going out and sales weren't strong enough.
Yeah.
But now our sales are strong, and provided the content is there, we should be fine.
And do you have a team now?
Team of 10 people.
10 people.
Okay. I'm a great believer that photographs without a narrative can be a little bit of in a vacuum. People want to tell stories.
Absolutely.
So we want to tell stories with narrative, and the book's got 65,000 words. Every picture's 300 words about what is not as important, because we all know that that's an elephant. We all know that that's a giraffe. Mm. So kind of what has been dumbed down is how.
Yeah.
We're in an era right now of how. Mm. And that means that we have to take a film crew everywhere we go.
Yeah.
If I go on my own, you can get back on a trip for $5,000. You got a film crew, it goes up 10 times.
Hmm.
But it's the right thing to do.
Yeah, Dan, and clearly you can tell a good story as well, so.
Well, we make most of them up.
If you've enjoyed listening to this episode, can I encourage you to follow the show by clicking the plus button in the top right-hand corner of your screen if you're listening via Apple Podcasts, or the follow button on Spotify and other platforms. It means you'll be the first to be notified whenever a new episode goes live. Did you know that nearly half of podcast listeners find the show through searching online? So if you've gotten any value at all, please share this episode with one or more of your friends and make it easy for them to find a podcast you think they'll enjoy. If you'd like to join the Screw It, Just Do It community, go to podpreneur.co.uk/get in touch to sign up to our weekly newsletter and free resources. That's podpreneur.co.uk/get-in-touch. That's podpreneur.co.uk/get-in-touch.